Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, Jim Gardner is known across the Delaware Valley as the face of Action News. He'll sit down with us to talk about his upcoming retirement. Also, a conversation with Philadelphia Zoo President Vikram Dhawan as he prepares to pass the baton. But first, the CDC has issued new and more expansive guidelines around the prescription of opioids to treat pain, updating its recommendations of 6 years ago. At the time, standards were more stringent, a reaction to the devastation wrought by the decades-long crushing wave of suffering wrought by opioid use disorder. In 2016, physicians were advised to limit dosages and stick to a timetable when it came to prescribing. But there were unintended consequences, experts say, for people who live with severe and chronic pain, and the updated guidelines attempt to address this. Dr. Jean Marie Perrone is an emergency and addiction medicine physician and the director of the Center for Addiction Medicine and Policy at Penn Medicine, and she's with us now on the Regional Roundup. Jean Marie Perrone, welcome back.
Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. So before we get to the new guidelines, let's take a look back at the 2016 recommendations and why they were put into place. Opioid medications like oxycodone and hydrocodone can be a godsend when it comes to relieving pain. But Jean Marie, they're also a double-edged sword for many people.
Yes, definitely. And we were very liberal in our opioid prescribing from the early 2000s to about 2012. And, you know, we realized that with that fourfold increase in opioid prescribing, we created an appetite for opioids that, you know, led people astray. Acute opioids are difficult to stop if patients have ongoing pain. And that's what part of the 2016 guidelines were attempting to address.
So as I understand it, physicians were asked to limit dosages and the length of time these medications were prescribed. What were the unintended consequences?
One of the aspects of the 2016 guideline was a specific number of opioids per day or dose per day. And they recommended that, and really, to be fair, studies showed that the risk of overdose increased greatly when you exceeded that amount of morphine equivalents per day. And so they actually recommended that people don't go over certain numbers because that's what's been associated with increasing overdose risk. However, that was a guideline, but that was interpreted by insurance companies and other clinician organizations as an absolute threshold. And so people were sometimes inappropriately or too rapidly tapered from higher dosages down to meet those threshold guidelines.
Are there patients who might need a more fluid opioid treatment plan, which might involve, say, you know, an ongoing without an end timetable?
Yes. And there are certainly many people who are stable on chronic opioids at a certain dosage that might be above that threshold. The plan to recommend tapering now is given with a lot of guidance in the new guidelines as a slower taper. And even more importantly, there's a lot of guidance to avoid starting opioids. Between 2016 and 2020, when this second guideline work started, there were multiple studies that showed the efficacy of non-opioid therapy. So you can't be on chronic opioids if you never get started on acute opioids. And so a lot of the new guidance is to really help clinicians be supported in the idea that many medicines such as ibuprofen or naproxen, things that we call non-steroidals, are equally effective, if not better, than opioids for acute pain. And so steering people away from even starting opioids is really an important aspect of this guideline.
Jean Marie, should we as patients expect medication to relieve all pain, or should we expect to deal with some pain as part of a plan for the best possible healing?
Yes. So you're really touching on pain scales and the severity of pain. We started measuring pain in that same decade, the 2000s, as a pain scale that was 1 out of 10 or a 10-point scale. And so patients who came in with severe pain often, you know, wanted to be validated. So they would say, you know, my pain is a 10 out of 10. That's why I came to the emergency department. And doctors sort of misapplied other regulations around treating pain to say, oh, we're going to get you down to, you know, 1 or 2, when really people really just need a reduction in the severity of their pain. And then to use other strategies to help understand how to manage pain. So a reduction in pain can be, you know, really tolerable if you go from 8 to 6 or 5, but we are not aiming for, you know, getting everyone who has severe pain down to 1 or 2, because that comes with other problems such as sedation and the inability to do other things that are important to you.
Is there any way to gauge whether a patient should not take opioids, say a history of addiction to other substances like perhaps alcohol?
I think the guidelines may be intended to outline opioid risk very clearly, and it is difficult to do that. But patients with a history of addiction are certainly at higher risk when it comes to opioids. Some other factors, even such as family history or other adverse childhood experiences, can also increase the risk of adverse events from opioids. So we do try to be cautious in assessing that risk. And what the guidelines really encourage is what we call shared decision making. So literally, if I'm seeing a patient in the emergency department and, you know, the husband has a broken arm and the wife is there, I'll talk to both of them about, you know, how do you feel about having your pain managed? You know, there's a certain risk if I give you 5 days of opioids versus, you know, you may feel better, less sedation, just getting a non-steroidal, a Motrin, and not having that risk. And together we can decide whether or not somebody wants to go forward, or a combination, a little bit of both, so that there's, you know, opioids maybe for nighttime pain and sleep, and non-steroidals for the rest of it. But having that discussion about risk is really important, and together we can make a more informed decision.
What makes opioids so addictive?
They work to, you know, numb or blunt pain response in the brain, but they also work in an area that's very close to our pleasure centers. So there is something we call euphoria associated with opioids. And it seems that not everybody has that same response that includes the euphoria component. Many people will tell you that they take opioids and they get sick from them. They get nauseous and they feel terrible. So being able to characterize who is going to get more euphoria and who is going to get less adverse events from them, it has been very difficult to predict. But I think individuals' response in the past can be informative going forward.
So with those who suffer from opioid use disorder, are there medications the CDC has gotten behind to treat this disorder?
Oh, yes. And, you know, that's such an important aspect of where we are. We're picking up the pieces of the opioid crisis with hundreds of thousands of people who now have opioid addiction. And very few of them are in treatment. About 20% of people who have known opioid use disorder are taking FDA endorsed and evidence-based medications. There are three, buprenorphine or Suboxone, methadone, and naltrexone. And all three of them have very good evidence that they can mitigate the harms, the risk of overdose death, the risk of non-fatal overdose, the risk of hepatitis and other infections. But very few people get engaged in treatment because there are barriers to finding providers. For methadone, you have to go to a program every day. So there are really important aspects of, you know, our work in preventing opioid use disorder by limiting the front end of opioid exposure via prescriptions.
This may sound like a question from left field, but could any of these opioids be prescribed to relieve pain?
Yes. So methadone certainly has a long history of being prescribed for chronic pain and cancer pain. So it can be prescribed outside of opioid treatment programs. But when it's used for opioid use disorder, there is that general requirement to be present at a clinic every single day. So that's very difficult. But it is basically just a long-acting opioid, somewhat similar to OxyContin, and really has the same effects, but also the same risks. For buprenorphine or Suboxone, it's an excellent medication for acute or chronic pain and underutilized for that, but also a very good medication for the treatment of opioid use disorder. And I think very few people know that there are such effective treatments, because when you get diagnosed with opioid use disorder and you go into treatment, many people are frustrated and exhausted, and they say, I want to be detoxed off of everything. And so they may enter a treatment program that does, in fact, wean them off of opioids. But at the end of 5 days or 2 weeks or a month, they don't realize that when they get discharged, the risk of fatal overdose is extraordinarily high. And we haven't really addressed the cravings and the physiologic drive that's going to push them back towards opioids. So it's not uncommon to hear the story of a family putting out a lot of resources to get someone into inpatient rehab and then ending up, you know, a few days or a few weeks after coming home as a fatal overdose. And the stigma and tragedy of all that fatal overdose often happens in the home, yeah. Where, you know, people weren't prepared with naloxone or other things that could reverse it. And there's really a lot of opportunity for education and treatment in that strategy.
Jean Marie Perrone, how would you change public health policy to address this situation?
I would lower all of the barriers to getting into treatment. In Philadelphia, we're pretty good. Most of the Medicaid and other insurance companies do pay for treatment and pay. There's no prior authorization for starting on buprenorphine. We have a telehealth program that can get people into treatment on the same day, regardless of insurance or financial sources. So we just need to have low barrier care for everyone so that we can save lives. The opioid crisis is now at 107,000 deaths a year and 1,250 or so in Philadelphia last year. So we're losing a lot of people that we can save.
And drug overdose deaths, to be clear, are up, but they're driven largely by synthetic opioids like fentanyl as opposed to prescription drugs. Is that correct?
That is definitely correct. Fentanyl is essentially a monster drug that has come into the market and also affected people who use cocaine and methamphetamine. So it's ubiquitous in its lethality in that, if you accidentally get exposed to a small amount, and especially if you have no opioid tolerance, you will have a non-fatal or fatal overdose. So we're seeing that increase in numbers. But buprenorphine works for fentanyl just like it worked for heroin. There might be some changes in dosing that we need to do, but it still is a very effective strategy, as is methadone.
Okay. And just to recap, we've got about 30 seconds left. Recap, if you would, the new CDC guidelines and the positive step forward in the guidelines around the prescription of opioids for us.
Yes, I think the new guidelines really help clinicians understand that they're guidelines and no substitute for clinical judgment. So we're not to adhere to them in all cases, but really encourages the use of non-opioid therapies for initiating the treatment of acute pain, and then for patients with subacute or chronic pain to set goals with patients so that when you start opioids or continue opioids, you can really address function and treatment at the same time.
All right. Thanks so much, Jean Marie Perrone. As always, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Jean Marie Perrone is director of the Center for Addiction Medicine and Policy at Penn Medicine. Stay with us here at the Regional Roundup. Veteran broadcaster Jim Gardner is in studio with us next. We'll talk. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Welcome back. Jim Gardner has had a front row seat to the history of the Philadelphia region as it's unfolded over the past 46 years. And as the longtime lead anchor and really the face of Action News at 6ABC, he's helped countless viewers navigate an often turbulent news landscape, the tough stories along with those which brought joy. Well, Jim Gardner is winding down his career this year, and he will walk away from the anchor chair for good at the end of December, and we are fortunate to have him with us right now in studio to share some of his story with us. Jim Gardner, welcome, welcome, welcome to the Regional Roundup. So
it's
good to
really
have you
nice
with us.
It's really nice to be here. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, is it starting to sink in?
What?
Oh, what?
Yes, it is. I try to sort of compartmentalize it a little bit and leave it in its rightful place and go to work every day.
Yeah. I'd rather you're actually thinking of retiring a little bit earlier, but the news in recent years was so interesting that you signed some extensions.
Yes. So I'm 74, and I guess the original notion was, you know, somewhere around 67, 68. But then Donald Trump became president of the United States, and I thought that that was such a compelling story and would lead to so many compelling stories that that was something that I really wanted to be around for. And then COVID came into our lives. And that was a story that I felt I just had to be a part of. So Trump and COVID kept me around a little bit longer than anticipated.
Yeah, well, as you just alluded to, the past, 5-6 years especially have been a roller coaster. Will you miss the adrenaline rush when you step back?
Sure. Yeah, not that the adrenaline rush happens every day, as you well know, but it happens frequently enough so that we look forward to it when it happens. And of course, I'll miss that. Yeah.
Yeah. So Jim, when you started your career at Action News in 1976, you were a reporter and the noon anchor. A year later, you were anchoring the so-called big broadcasts, those at 6 and 11. Must have been a heady time for a young man in his 20s. You were just coming off, television work in Buffalo, right?
I was. It was the same company. In those days, WKBW in Buffalo and WPBI in Philadelphia were owned by Capital Cities Communications, which was a very small company that eventually bought ABC. So it really was, the mouse swallowing the elephant. But coming to Channel 6 in Philadelphia, I was 27, 28 years old, and the opportunity to be in Philadelphia was extraordinary, and to work at a place like WPBI was extraordinary. It had the reputation of being a fabulous place to work, and it was. And all I wanted to do was to learn as much as I could every day. I had no particular ambitions to climb some ladder of hierarchy. I just wanted to soak up as much as I could. And that was my attitude. And it was extraordinary to be here.
You were born and raised in New York City, is that right?
In Manhattan, correct.
So yeah. What did you think of Philly? Such a different town.
Well, it's different, but I thought that the feel was very much the same. I felt immediately comfortable in Philadelphia. If New York has 800, that's silly, but if it has 80 Thai restaurants, well, Philadelphia had three, and three was more than enough for me. But Philadelphia had all the sports that I cherish. It has the orchestra, it has theater, it has everything that I could want in a city. And I loved the culture of Philadelphia. I love the lack of pretense, the underdog culture, if you will. I've always sort of been an underdog type person with much, whenever there's a game that I don't have a particular rooting interest in, I always hope for the underdog to win. And not that Philadelphia needs any more help than it gets, but There is such energy in this city. Mm-hmm. There is so much pride in this city. I love the fact that there are so many people who are born here, who stay here, who grow old here, and who die here. It's the emotional investment by Philadelphians in Philadelphia is unusual, and it's a great feeling.
Yeah, despite the challenges, it's not hard to fall in love with Philly. I'm not from here either, and it feels like home.
Yeah. And there are challenges, obviously. There are challenges in every city and every region of the country. But, I think we'll do okay by them.
The news, as we all know, can land a gut punch sometimes. Which stories, Jim Gardner, were among the toughest for you to cover here in the Philly area?
Well, the crime situation right now is a gut punch, if there ever was one. And it's our job to report the news. It's not our job to figure out how to solve problems in a sense, but we struggle every day as reporters, but also as citizens of this region, to try to figure out if there are answers and what they may be. But the the overwhelming presence of gun violence and
suffering
and homicide in Philadelphia, and yes, it is not unique in this problem with urban America today, but I think Philadelphia, if one were to analyze the numbers, Philadelphia is certainly a leader of that crisis. And, it's terrible. And so that is certainly a gut punch. COVID was as gut punchy as one could imagine. If for no other reason, it was a multi, and it made it interesting as well as a from a journalist point of view. It's a story that had tentacles that reached into every element of our lives. It was a health story, a medical story, an economic story, a sociological story, in that Americans were all of a sudden isolated from their families and from their children, from their parents, from their partners. And of course, it became a political story that we still have very much a part of our everyday existence. So it was an extraordinary story, a fascinating story, and just one of the more difficult stories to cover, and a story where I do think we were in a position to help our viewers. Again, as I said, our job primarily is to report the news. With a story like COVID, we felt every day that we were imparting information that was a help to our viewers, and that was important.
As I understand it, Jim, you've interviewed every sitting president and major presidential candidate since the late 70s. Which interview left the most lasting impression on you? Everyone, perhaps, because it's you're sitting and you're talking to a president.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I was just a bit overwhelmed to be talking to the first African-American president. I mean, the fact, and forget what you may or may not feel about Barack Obama, but the historical significance of his election is overwhelming. And, that made a huge impression on me. I thought that George H.W. Bush was as gracious a man as I have met. He had a great sense of humor. I had an opportunity to interview him twice in the White House and also at Kennebunkport, where he is so relaxed, so much at ease, that it was just a wonderful experience for me as a questioner, as an interviewer. We talked about a lot of things that I never thought I would, have an opportunity to talk to him about. And he was just absolutely gracious. I had a funny story. Do I have time to tell a funny story? So George W. Bush was campaigning in Philadelphia back in 2000 for the first his first term. And he had a big event in media, and they set up grandstands outside the courthouse. And it was a very big deal, his first time in Delaware County. And it was about 105 degrees out there. And he, first of all, he didn't love retail politics to begin with, despite the fact that he was governor of Texas, had been governor of Texas. And we were the setup. We were the photographers and the audio people for what would be a succession of local interviews. Every television station would get 8-9 minutes, but it was our crew. So we expected him to walk into this room in the courthouse, say, at 1 o'clock. Well, he walks in at about 12:40. His suit is soaked.
Gosh.
He is soaked, and he's very cranky. It's my job now to sit and have a conversation with him for about 20 minutes until we're ready to do the interview. And he's not happy. So I'm just struggling to figure out what to talk about. So how is the campaign going? And he could care less about having that conversation. Finally, I got a little light bulb that went off, and I said, "So you're the guy who traded Sammy Sosa." Sammy Sosa, of course, had been a member of the Texas Rangers, and George Bush is managing partner of the Texas Rangers. The Bush family owned the baseball team. Traded him to the White Sox. People don't realize that, who then traded him to the Chicago Cubs, where he became this megastar. As soon as I said that, his eyes opened wide, his whole face brightened, and we spent the next 15, 20, 25 minutes talking about baseball. And he enjoyed every minute of it, as did I. And he knows his baseball. To show that sports can be a common language under any and all circumstances, yeah. And we had a great time. And
you
it was a good interview.
Fan. You're a Sixers fan, correct?
Oh, of course. I'm everything in Philadelphia.
What did you think of Joel Embiid yesterday?
59 points, was that it? Oh, my goodness. Yeah,
not bad.
Really?
Yeah, so there's hope for them.
They'll work it out. They'll figure it
they
out.
They will work it out. That's right. So, you know, I on the lighter side, the 11 o'clock show leads into Jimmy Kimmel, and during a tribute in 2017, the 40th anniversary on the air, Kimmel says of you, Jim has the gravitas of Walter Cronkite, the tenacity of Ted Koppel, and the mustache of Ron Burgundy. And for those of our listeners who don't know who Ron Burgundy is, famously played by Will Ferrell in Anchorman. But, you know, this has been a part of you, Jim, you know, your mustache since the beginning. I don't remember seeing you on television, and I've been watching you since the 80s without that mustache.
All right.
So here, there's a question.
It's something that I obviously is not in my consciousness. But
no. Well, it won the attention of Jimmy Kimmel. But anyway, are you tempted to make a change with a fresh start?
So my youngest child, Jesse, who is a senior at Vanderbilt University, is campaigning me to shave the mustache off the day after my last newscast. Hmm. I don't know. I'll give it some thought.
Not one of the weightier questions I've ever gotten into. But, you know, the broadcast world is, as we know, it can be at times a business of ego, but it's also good to be able to laugh at ourselves. I mean, you've had moments on the air, as we all have, because it's live, in which stuff happens. Anything memorable? Aside from Cecily Tynan's earring, meteorologist.
That was fun. Jim O'Brien told me, and I thought it was an important lesson. He said, if something happens that's funny in the studio, you react to it. Don't ever pre-plan anything. Don't ever rehearse anything, because the viewers, the audience, will know that it's not authentic. And I think I don't like to compare us to other television stations, because everybody does a really good job, particularly in Philadelphia. I think all three stations, four stations, are excellent. Sometimes you can tell that an anchor or two anchors, co-anchors, are talking about something that they have talked about just prior to coming back on the air during the commercial break. That is something we just never do. If it's not spontaneous, it's not happening. So Gary Papa and Dave Roberts used to be able to make me laugh or lose it at will. They just had that ability. And it's funny. Things go in cycles. We could go months without anything happening in the studio that was, let's say, untoward or funny. And then we could go for 2 or 3 weeks where almost every day something would seem to be happening that, you know, where we would sort of lose our composure. Was it too much for the audience? Maybe, but it also made us look a little human. So, you know, it's okay. You know, if it happens, if it's funny, then we react to it. If it's not funny, we don't react.
When you made the announcement, Jim, that you'd be stepping back from Action News, there was an outpouring of support and thanks, both locally and nationally. Too many tributes to play here, but here's two from ABC's Dave Muir and Jimmy Kimmel.
We have some breaking news tonight. Jim Gardner, on the air for 40 years. You know, everyone thinks it's the Action News theme that draws you in all these years, but we know it's really Jim Gardner.
There's a lot of fake news out there these days, so much fake news, but one man has always given it to us straight. Jim has the gravitas of Walter Cronkite, the tenacity of Ted Koppel, and the mustache of Ron Burgundy. All the greats wrapped up into one. Nobody would.
All right, we went back to the mustache again. Sorry about that. But
I had the mustache when I went to work at WKBW in Buffalo. And someone there suggested maybe you'd think of not having the mustache. And I said, sure, fine, no problem. And I shaved it. And one of the first stories I did was a story about how difficult it was for college graduates to get jobs. This was 1974 when, you know, we did have employment crises and recession. So I did a stand-up at the end of the piece surrounded by seniors at the University of Buffalo. I look like the youngest person in that group. So the person who asked me, the manager who asked me to shave off the mustache, came to me after that piece and said, maybe we'd want to reconsider.
You never
looked
back.
So I grew it back.
So, you know, the journalism landscape has shifted somewhat since the late 70s, early 80s. What makes good journalism in 2022? And what do journalists need to watch for to make sure that journalism stays on track and objective?
Yeah, I think this is a complicated problem today.
And we've got about a minute to solve that complicated problem.
That's great. For years, the idea was objectivity and, you know, let's hear from both sides.
Yeah.
In 2022, what if one side is intent on spreading misinformation and not telling the truth? So I think we've got to be a little more nuanced than we have been over the decades. So if good journalism is seeking out truth based on facts that can be proven, that to me makes – that's more comfortable for me right now than just say – here's a statement, and let's hear from both sides.
Yeah.
That may no longer be adequate in our efforts to do good journalism.
Well, listen, as you prepare to step back, best of luck. Have fun.
Thank you. I will. I'll make every effort.
It was great to have you in studio with us. Jim Gardner, veteran broadcaster, 6ABC Action News. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, up next on the Regional Roundup, Philadelphia Zoo CEO Vikram Dhawan. Stay close.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The oldest zoo in the country has implemented some groundbreaking innovations in recent years under the tutelage of its president and CEO, Vikram Dhawan. Dhawan is beginning to lay the groundwork for his eventual successor at the Philadelphia Zoo. He plans to step back next year, so we've asked him to visit with us to discuss his work of the past 16 years, including efforts to transform the zoo into a place that increasingly feels like a natural home to its well over 1,000 animals. We'll also talk about the zoo's concerted effort to become an integral part of the Philadelphia community, and we'll ask Dhawan to tell us how he envisions the evolution of zoos as we move more deeply into the 21st century. Vikram Dhawan joins us live now in the Regional Roundup. Vic, great to have you with us.
Thank you, Mary.
So 16 years at the helm of the Philadelphia Zoo, why is now the time to consider passing the baton?
Well, it's not only just 16 years at the Philadelphia Zoo, but 16 of what have been the very best years of my life. I have really been honored to be the leader here. At the same time, I am an individual who really believes in planned succession. You know, as zoos and as so many other organizations, we deal with so much uncertainty all the time. And if there is one element of what we do, which is leadership and how we look at leadership, if we can do that in a more thoughtful way, if we can plan it and get good stakeholder input and other things around that, just that removes one element of uncertainty around that. So big believer in planned succession and felt like 16 years, wonderful time here, but it may be very much time for another leader to get their imprint on the organization as we think about our future.
Well, one of your imprints, innovations, which literally, Vic, made headlines around the world, is Zoo 360. Describe this for those of us who haven't had a chance to experience something like the big cat crossing in which animals are given the opportunity to walk around and over various areas of the zoo, observing humans from above while humans look up to observe them.
Yeah, well, Zoo 360 certainly is a signature part of what defines Philadelphia Zoo. And in so many ways, when one thinks about innovation or new ideas, they're oftentimes born out of something that needed to happen, something that needed to change. And Philadelphia Zoo, although we are incredibly lucky to have 42 wonderful acres here in Philadelphia, we've oftentimes been asked the question of, well, what can you do to get more space? Because, you know, you have over almost 1.3 million visitors a year. Can get crowded there. Why don't you go get some more space? And in so many ways, as we were approaching this issue of thinking about that question, it became really quickly evident to us that we were thinking about space in two dimension and not in three dimension. And the minute we started thinking in three dimension, the dimension of height, we had almost limitless space to be able to think about how to transform the experience that visitors have at the Philadelphia Zoo. And then, very importantly, the experience that our animals have at Philadelphia Zoo every single day, and to create a set of pathways that cross the entire zoo in an aerial format, in an arboreal format, going through trees and other pathways. And so we started 10 years ago with this crazy idea of, well, what if we could create a set of passageways and pathways that could allow our animals to explore the zoo? And here we are 10 years later. We have now a significant number of these pathways all across the zoo that give our animals an opportunity to roam and to be able to experience different parts of the zoo, and our visitors to see animals in different ways and in different circumstances. And now, 10 years later, this crazy idea that we had come up with is now in 60 zoos across the world.
So have you noticed a difference in the animals' demeanor since these catwalks and other trails were constructed?
So funny you should ask that question. You know, it's so easy to anthropomorphize what it is that animals are experiencing when they go through these trails. But what I will say to you that for those of us who see these animals every single day, what we love, I mean, absolutely love, is seeing behaviors and experiences that one typically don't see in a zoo setting. You see animals traveling through these trails. You see them vocalizing to one another, speaking to one another. You see them able to create behavior types that in a static environment you wouldn't see. And so we absolutely love seeing that. And then there is something that takes your breath away when you see a tiger, a magnificent tiger, go over your head. Maybe as human beings, our brains are wired when we're in the presence of a predator to just sort of have that sort of immediate reaction. But when you get that close that you can almost smell them, I mean, it's just an incredible experience. We do think that's what makes a zoo experience so meaningful and so engaging for visitors.
Well, let's get to the old argument about, you know, keeping animals in zoos in the first place. You know, those who are opposed say, isn't their natural habitat the best option for them? Why have zoos in the first place, even as they're working very hard to make these make the experience good for animals?
Yeah, Marian, as someone who grew up not really feeling comfortable about being in zoos, it's a question that I welcome. I think that everything in our society today needs to meet the test of relevance. It needs to meet the test of impact. And to ask the question about sort of why do you need a zoo? What purpose does it serve? How and in what way does it advance our understanding of the challenges of our planet and the like, I think is an incredibly important question. And for me personally, it wasn't until I was an adult that I loved going to zoos. And in part, it's because one needs to understand what the impact and relevance of zoos really are in our everyday lives. I will say that in the course of these last couple of years in particular, as we have been looking not only at the issues of our changing climate and the impact that it's having on our world, but further, also looking at the human-animal conflict. We now have almost 8 billion human beings on our planet.
Yeah.
And the areas for animals are constantly shrinking. And in the conflict between human and animals, mostly humans win. And these areas shrink, and we are vastly and quickly seeing animals becoming extinct. But if we ever needed a true story of where this human-animal conflict can impact us every single day, no matter where we live, we simply need to understand that the pandemic may have started by a bat in a wet market somewhere on the other side of the world, and it brought the entire world economy to a halt. And we need to understand that we as human beings have a very fragile planet and that ecosystems really matter. And our ability to live in harmony with animals around the world, whether that's in another part of the world or in our own backyard here in Philadelphia, such an important part of making sure that we have a healthy climate and that we have healthy ecosystems for human beings as well as animals.
Speaking of the
zoo can play a very important role. Go ahead. Sorry, Mary.
No, I'm sorry for jumping in. But, you know, you mentioned our backyard. The zoo is doing an enormous amount of outreach within the local Philadelphia community. Victor Juan, what spurred this effort?
Really important comment. I mean, back to just my last comment around sort of what role do zoos play. I do think that zoos live uniquely in the intersection of the issues around environmental justice and social justice. I really believe that that's the unique space that we play and show our impact and relevance. And in so many ways, Philadelphia Zoo is unique among cultural institutions in Philadelphia because we're actually embedded in the neighborhoods. Our core visitation base is the most diverse of any institution in Philadelphia. And so in so many ways, the health of the Philadelphia Zoo depends on the health of the ecosystem around us, and that ecosystem is West Philadelphia. It is the neighborhoods around us that are challenged by the issues around economic mobility. And so we have really looked at innovation now, not only in the sense of what we can do with Zoo 360, but some of the programmatic innovations that we're looking at. And those include some of our outreach into the neighborhoods around the Philadelphia Zoo in a very hyper-local fashion, looking at ways in which we can engage the communities around us in ways that I think uniquely define what may be the next chapter of innovation for Philadelphia. So that includes our youth programs, that includes our neighborhood membership programs, and increasingly as we're starting to think about what role can Philadelphia Zoo play in being able to change the dialogue around how to make sure that these communities and neighborhoods around us can share in the economic growth and economic activity as well.
Victor Juan, I read in published reports that during your tenure, you helped the zoo reduce its debt, grow its endowment, membership revenues are up. At the end of the day, you know, of course, the numbers have to add up. Were there moments of anxiety and uncertainty around everything, how everything would play out, especially when COVID hit?
Oh, my. Yes, definitely. No question about it, Mary. I think that for so many years, we had been thinking that the most important and effective way in which we could operate the organization is to make sure that we had programs that people wanted to support through their membership and through their visitation and the like, and that we were very grateful for our donors and that our donors would be able to support our programs and capital investments. That was a great idea until there weren't any visitors. And that was 111 days from March to July of 2020 in the beginning of the pandemic. And that was an existential moment for us. It really was. That said, we made our way through 2020, not only with being able to get through that with a financial model and, you know, ensuring that people were able to visit once it was safe to do so from a public health perspective, people really stepped up with their support to the Philadelphia Zoo. Great that you had Jim Gardner on before. 6ABC has been a great partner to us in making sure that those messages around, if you have a Philadelphia Zoo, you want to make sure that it can remain healthy from a financial perspective.
Sure.
Mary, it was unusual to get a banker to come to Philadelphia Zoo 16 years ago.
And that was you.
Have such amazing, that was me. That was me. And someone without a zoo background, without an animal background. It was a very unusual step that our board took. But they took it believing that our core issue wasn't animal well-being. We do an excellent job with our staff here in being able to translate around how we take care of our animals, how we bring the message of conservation and all that. What our challenge was 16 years ago was building a model for financial resilience. And it's so important that nonprofits have both a plan for financial resilience and a plan for mission impact, and both have to be present in order for an organization to succeed.
Vic, I also understand on a lighter note that you've developed some friendships among the animals over the years. Care to share?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know who told you that, but it is absolutely true. Absolutely true. Absolutely, like so many of us here at the zoo, have our favorite animals. It's impolitic for a CEO to say what their favorite animal is, but for me, it's tigers. I absolutely love and adore our tigers. Always have from the first day I was here. And we have an incredibly charismatic white rhino, Tony. When I have difficult moments, I go out there and chat with him. He listens carefully and oftentimes able to get great advice back.
Oh, and I guess you're an animal lover at home as well.
Indeed. You know, I think that so many of us who work at the Philadelphia Zoo are also pet owners. I think in so many ways, our animals that are around us is what defines us as human beings. And so not only have I always been a dog person from the day I was a little kid and was had a dog in my life, but I'm also married to Jamie, who fosters cats and kittens from ACT. And so our home is always overrun with cats. Anybody who's looking to foster and adopt cats, let us know. We've always got some great ones that we've been fostering. And some of the fostering fails, so they hang around with us for a little bit longer.
I understand the foster fail.
But indeed.
But no more exotic species, I'm guessing. I mean, speaking of which, our friends at local animal shelters can tell you, you know, sometimes people keep exotic pets at home. Safe to say, Vic DeJuan, not good for the animal or the human.
Indeed, not good. These exotic animals are amazing ambassadors that tell us the story of what the challenges in the wild are, but they generally do not make good pets. And so really encourage people not to do that. And check with us on our website. We've got really good ideas on best bets for pets and things that you can do to make sure you're picking the right pets. But dogs and cats and other such animals, wonderful pets to have in our lives and great companions.
So we've got about a half minute left. Vic DeJuan, what is next for you after you pass the baton as CEO of the Philadelphia Zoo?
Mary, I talked a little bit about these issues of environmental and social justice. I think that they are so key to our understanding of our place in this world that we live in. And the social issues of our time are really significant. And after 25 plus years in banking and now 16 years in the not-for-profit sector, I hope that I can continue to give back. And the area that I'm passionate about is this intersection of environmental and social justice, especially in Philadelphia, in our city, in our hometown.
Sorry to jump in. Thank you so much, Vic DeJuan, president of the Philadelphia Zoo. Great talking with you.
And with you, Mary. Thank you.
And that wraps up our final regional roundup show. We are part of Radio Times. And as you might have heard, Radio Times is ending its 35-year run this week. It's been my pleasure and privilege to host the roundup. Could not have done this without our intrepid producer, Paige Murray Bessler. Thank you, Paige. Also, thanks to Radio Times producer Debbie Bilder for her help. And input engineer Diana Martinez kept us on the air and sounding strong, even through the inevitable and occasional live radio glitches. And of course, many thanks to Marty Moscawain for giving me this amazing opportunity. To our listeners, we couldn't have done this without you. I'll be back with the WHYY News team soon, where I'll do some hosting. And as always, you can find today's regional roundup at WHYY.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks again for joining us. Be well.